Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. As always, thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. On today's program, we've got Dayton Youth Radio. And later in the program, a conversation with a Yellow Springs resident involved with her local Threshold Choir chapter. If you're not familiar with their work, stay tuned. Up first, three Miami Valley civic leaders and one of the city's top arts organizations have been inducted into the Dayton Regional Walk of Fame. The 2019 inductees were honored at the annual ceremony Thursday at Sinclair College. This year's honorees include civil rights leader Jesse Gooding Jr., entrepreneur John Gower, and philanthropist Betsy and Lee Whitney, and the Dayton Contemporary Dance Company. Jesse Gooding was the longest-serving president of the Dayton NAACP. He was honored for his fight to end discrimination in education, employment, housing, and law enforcement. Gooding says others joined him in his fight for civil rights at the time. He says very few blacks were hired by downtown businesses.
When I came here in 1947, there were no black folks downtown in any department stores as clerks. The police department had the minimum number of blacks officers, and they couldn't arrest white folks. And in the General Motors, most folks was there was janitors. NCR would hire any blacks in the plant, but in the foundry, they let them work in the foundry.
Changes that the city of Dayton has undergone is reflected in the lives of each of the Walk of Fame inductees this year. In fact, it has been a central part of John Gower's lifelong work in urban development, in which he says his interest came to him at a young age.
And I remember my folks driving us around. I had three sisters when I was 5, 6, 7 years old. Every Sunday we'd go out and drive around the city and look at the neighborhoods. I grew up when they were demolishing all the buildings downtown for urban renewal and the freeways, and at that time I thought that was so cool. Went to high school in the late 60s, early 70s downtown, watched the Kettering Tower come out of the ground, the Grant Deneau building coming out of the ground, and I was smitten. I mean, I didn't realize this, but by the time I was through with high school and headed to college, I'd fallen hopelessly in love with this place.
Walk of Fame recipients Betsy and Lee Whitney were inducted in large part for their support of the arts in Dayton. She says even in the tough times, the city has managed to move forward.
I think people always sort of rise to the occasion and new things happen. The combination of the arts, DPAA for dance, the dance, ballet, opera, and the Philharmonic is a wonderful thing. And then they always go to the schools and teach, work with the kids. The art, there's lots of new art going on for all ages, which I think is important. The library, I think, is filling a very important spot downtown and in the region with all their new buildings.
The organization credited with sharing Dayton's art and culture with audiences worldwide is the Dayton Contemporary Dance Company, honored for its 50 years of cultural performances at home and abroad. The dance company was founded in 1968 by Geraldine Blunden, who was herself inducted into the Walk of Fame in 1999. Since its founding, the Dayton Contemporary Dance Company has performed in countries around the world, Chile, China, Russia, Kazakhstan, and others. DCDC CEO Renita Hawes Saunders and Debbie Blunden Diggs, Chief Artistic Administrator and Producing Director for DCDC, accepted the award for the dance company. Blunden Diggs, the founder's daughter, says that when the company tours abroad, they take Dayton with them, not only in their name, but in spirit as well.
You know, Geraldine's dream was to root the company here, and we've never moved it, and we don't have any plans on moving it. It is where we were born, and every place we go, we certainly carry the name because it's called the Dayton Contemporary Dance Company, but the spirits of the dancers and the artists who come here and make Dayton their home, and as we travel from place to place, there's just this energy and synergy that travels with us. And we talk about Dayton being a great place to be, a great place to live, how rich our arts community is.
Hawes Saunders echoed that sentiment in her speech to the large audience gathered at Sinclair's Ponant Center.
And I can talk about it from the spirit and soul in which our artists work each and every day to bring this community, this nation, and this world exceptional art on a continuous basis.
With Thursday's ceremony complete, 180 Dayton area residents, leaders, and changemakers have now been inducted into the Regional Walk of Fame, an annual event that began in 1996. The Dayton Walk of Fame is located along West 3rd Street between Shannon and Broadway Streets in the historic Wright-Dunbar Business District. Check it out. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. This week on Dayton Youth Radio, we feature 18-year-old Devin Gum, a high school senior from Centerville who will be voting for the first time in next year's presidential election. It's with that in mind that we invite you to listen to an interview Devin did with his dad, Kevin.
Do you think that Trump made America great again?
I think America's stronger now. He's made great strides in our deals we have with Asia, Mexico, and Canada.
How would you rate Trump's overall performance?
I'd rate it pretty high.
What do you admire that Trump has done?
Like all the jobs that he's created and brought back to the United States. It's just making a stronger economy. And I liked definitely that he's added two conservative judges to the Supreme Court. That's going to go for decades. I mean,
is he one of your favorite presidents?
Definitely. He's probably done more than any other president I've seen.
I remember waking up in the morning and getting on Facebook to see my father going crazy in celebration of Trump being voted into office. If you didn't know any better, you would have thought that he won the lottery. Me and my dad's disagreement on Trump has caused a lot of heated dinner table debate. Sometimes we will get straight into arguing before we even think about eating. Since the time I was a boy, I can remember my dad going off on political rants supporting the Republicans and his reasoning behind why everything the Democrats do is wrong. Naturally, me growing up hearing these things, I now have Republican views that reflect my father's. But there's one thing that we've never agreed on. Donald Trump. Trump is the ultimate drama queen and bully all in one. I never supported Trump, and I've only further disagreed with his decisions the longer he's been in office. The main reason among many that I do not support Trump is because he rants on Twitter about his issues and conflicts in the office. For example, Trump tweeted, "Truly weird Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky reminds me of a spoiled brat without a properly functioning brain." I thought that we were supposed to hire a focused politician to represent America. Do you think that it's childish of Trump to get on Twitter to bring all his political drama and issues to?
He's just being attacked on all fronts, and it's a way for him to get out there and say what they're saying about him isn't true, what's false, and get his opinions out there. I think that most news organizations are bought and paid for. I'm at the point where I do not watch any news or read any news except for Fox. They write things that are more truthful.
When it comes time for me to pull the lever at the voting booth in 2020, I'm really not sure who I'm going to vote for. Staying loyal to the Republicans and voting for Trump, or taking a chance against my previous political views and beliefs and voting for the winner of the Democratic primary. Trying to find the right candidate for me has been a struggle because I just turned 18, and the realization that I'm going to have the right to vote hit me all at once. This is why it's so important for me and my dad to debate at home and to always listen to both sides of the story. The political divide might be strong enough to separate this country, but it will never be strong enough to separate my family. I'm Devin Gum, Dayton Youth Radio.
That's a story called 2020 Vision. Written and produced by Devin Gum, a senior at Centerville High School. Special thanks to Trisha Raypock. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basine Blunt.
This story was created at the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend. Up next, a story that began in 1990 when a woman named Kate Munger was losing her friend Larry, who was dying of HIV/AIDS. Larry was in a coma, and Munger says she was terrified as she sat with him before his passing. So she says she did what she always did when she was afraid. She sang for him for 2.5 hours. Munger says the singing gave her courage and seemed to soothe Larry. Years later, as Munger tells the story, she was driving home from a trip to Montana and decided to sing for any animals she passed that had been killed on the road. Those two moments, according to Munger, combined with her love of singing, were the inspiration for the Threshold Choir. Small groups of women who sing for the ill, but mostly for people who are dying. Today, the choir that began with one group of 15 women now has chapters in states across the U.S. and more than 200 chapters around the world, volunteers singing to folks who are facing death, grief, or suffering. More than 100 Threshold singers from dozens of chapters throughout the Midwest are gathering in Yellow Springs this weekend. Joan Ackerman lives in Yellow Springs and has been singing with the Threshold chapter there for about 8 years. We spoke to her about how she got into singing for people who were dying.
Very meaningful. I think it's very, very important work. It's lullabies for people in transition, at the end of their lives, going through difficult time, healing. Not always the very end of one's life, but usually. And it's very, very, it's enriching. It really makes me feel, think about people, think about myself, be mindful. I found it to be a very good addition to my life.
What drew you to that activity? I would think it could be scary. The thought of it, but so tell me a little bit about your initial feelings and how that has changed in your time.
Right. I think that's true, and you don't find many threshold singers who are very young, although there are some. Most of us are people of a certain age. You know, we're it's more towards the end of days than the beginning of days, and we have a lot of there are a lot of goodbyes, and we've had to come to terms with the fact that there will be a goodbye, and for ourselves as well. And it's not a morbid kind of thought. It's an optimistic thought that when our time is over, we can leave this earth hopefully surrounded by joyful sounds. And joyful thoughts. And we have there is a song in our repertoire that says something like, when I was born, I cried, and the world rejoiced. Live your life so that when you die, the world cries and you rejoice. It's almost like accepting it as something that will be happening to all of us, and trying to make it as positive for ourselves as and for others as we can.
Tell me about the bond that develops with your fellow singers.
It's interesting because we have very like-minded people for the most part, people who have come from all walks of life, but find this work to be very important and very rewarding. And we don't really socialize together. Maybe some of us do from time to time, but basically we meet once a week and we practice. And then one of those meetings we do at Friends Care, and while we're practicing singing, we're singing to a group of residents, who choose to be there, which is different from going into a particular room or to a particular client. One-on-one, there's just one person in one bed with maybe their loved ones around them. And that's a very different kind of thing than what we do when we do it at Friends Care. But we feel both of those are meaningful contributions. And the bond is really a bond of wanting to be of service. Basically, that's what it's about, wanting to be of service at a very tender time.
And tell me about the reaction of the loved ones in from someone who's passing in hospice.
Yeah, and that's very interesting because we only go where we're invited. We don't just show up and say, we have a gift for you. It's a gift we feel we are providing for those who would like it. And some of our group goes every week, once a week, to hospice in Springfield. And we'll just go around and sing to whoever the nurses have identified that the families are interested in having us sing for just a few minutes. It's never more than 10 minutes. And it's never more than three or four at the most at a time. It's a very small group. It's not as if we're trying to overwhelm anybody. And basically, we find that not only the recipient, who sometimes isn't even able to, isn't conscious enough for us to get a response from, although, quite frankly, we're told that the last thing that goes is hearing. So we like to think even if they're non-responsive, they're hearing us. But the response from the family is almost uniformly very grateful and makes us feel that our presence there has made a difference and has helped the situation.
Did you always sing or sing in other capacities earlier in life?
Yeah. I did love to sing. My instrument is my voice. I sang in high school in the choir, and it was a very good choir. We sang in, we were invited to sing in many places outside of the school setting. And then, of course, as life would happen, I had my family and went on my way doing other things and really didn't start singing again until I started singing with Threshold Singers. But singing is something that I've always done. I'm not a trained singer, and that's the other thing. We are all really volunteer singers. Some people think that they really don't sing well, but they come to do this work and learn that, wow, they do have something to give. Some of us appreciate the musicality of it. In other words, we can sing just melody. We can sing harmonies. Almost all of our songs have harmonies. But we sometimes just sing melody depending upon who's singing. I personally love singing harmony. I like to sing the soprano harmony part, although I'll do melody too if asked. But no, none of us are really trained musicians, although many people have musical backgrounds. They've played instruments or they have sung in other kinds of settings. But most of us, as I think of our group, most of them don't even read music. So we just pick it up by ear. It's simple melodies. It's easy to do.
You mentioned that you sing in small groups to not make the situation overwhelming for anyone going through this. Mm-hmm. But there's quite a large group that will be meeting this weekend.
Yeah, this is a very exciting event. This is, I think, the 13th or 14th time we've done it. I lose count. But this is what's called the Midwest Gathering. So choir members from all around the Midwest will be coming to Yellow Springs. We've had it in various places over the years, and most recently we've settled on the hotel, the Mills Park Hotel, in their large events room. We'll have 100 women. 100 voices will be raised. We will practice. We will learn new music. We will learn about end-of-life issues. We'll have confront our own end-of-life issues in some ways. And one of the most marvelous parts is that the founder of the Threshold International now, because we do have choirs all over the world, Kate Munger, is here to lead this weekend event. And we're very excited about it, very, very excited about this opportunity. This will very possibly be her last time as she's facing redirecting or retiring, and trying to figure out what the next steps are. I'm not sure if we'll be doing it again in Yellow Springs or some other Midwest choir would like to do it. It's up for grabs, but we just might be back here again next year. We don't know. But right now, we're just looking forward to a wonderful, wonderful time this weekend, starting Friday night, all day Saturday night, Sunday morning until around noon. We will all come away feeling really, really inspired.
And where can people go to find out more about this event?
About this event? Well, this event is really not open to the public.
Unfortunately. That's right.
It's a closed event based on those of us who have registered and there's just so many people, and you have to be a threshold singer to be part of it. But if people want to find out more about Threshold Choir and the whole movement, they can go to the website. It's on the website, and there's a whole lot of information about it. And anybody who's interested in joining our local group just needs to let us know. It's open. to anyone who really wants to participate in this mission.
As we've been talking, we've heard some beautiful music in the background. Tell us what we're listening to.
You're listening to the Portland Threshold Singers, which they are an incredibly wonderful group. As a matter of fact, a few years ago, Portland hosted the National Threshold Singers gathering. And in my view, their quality of singing is almost professional. But they are also, like us, a lay group. And they have put out this CD. Part of it is we have a few CDs that help us learn the music more and get a better feeling for some of the music. And this is one of my favorites.
Joan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for your interest. I really appreciate that.
And again, you can find out more about that organization at thresholdchoir.org.
May only joy surround you. May only joy surround you. May only joy surround you. May only joy surround you.
I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. On November 9th, the Air Force Museum Theater at Wright-Patt will hold the world film premiere of the Lafayette Escadrille. The feature-length documentary, filmed on both sides of the Atlantic, tells the story of a U.S. unit of volunteers under French command who came forward to fight for France during World War I. The film draws a dotted line from Dayton and the Wright brothers to one of the founders of the fighting unit, Norman Prince. That line continues on to France and to early flying and the advent of American military aviation. For the scoop on this film, we talked to one of the producers, WISO's aviation commentator, Dan Patterson.
This film began several years ago as I was beginning to work on a magazine article about the unit, and we quickly discovered that this is a story really that's been lost to history. And so the more we dug into this, the more fascinating it became. The project started when I met one of the descendants of the original pilots, Norman Prince. This is his great-grandnephew. Norman was killed before he was able to have children. And what we found out is Norman Prince learned to fly in a Wright Flyer. Wright State has a photograph of Norman Prince at Huffman Prairie. So he is the link in the chain between the early experiments of the Wright brothers and military flying. And that alone is a great story.
So there's definitely a connection to the Miami Valley.
There sure
several,
is. Absolutely.
Actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about working on the film. When did you start this?
This project started about 4.5 years ago, actively working on the film. I met Régis Duhamel, the descendant of Norman Prince, 10 years ago, and pitched the idea eventually to Air and Space Smithsonian Magazine. And Paul Glenshaw and I did an article for this Air and Space Magazine, and the film has kind of percolated out of that project.
You are one of three producers.
That's correct.
All right. And some filming done on both sides of the Atlantic.
That is right. We've made two filming trips to France in the last 4 years, which is a nice gig to do. We filmed in 40 locations in France. Nearly all the locations where this unit flew and lived and fought.
I imagine that with filming here and across the ocean, I imagine there's some beautiful cinematography in here.
There is. We've worked with a couple of really great videographers. I've done a little bit of filming, not a lot, but the country of France is really a character of the film because the First World War was mainly fought in France. These guys went to fly for France, and France has never forgotten what they did. These guys are revered in France. The French Air Force still maintains the unit, and Mirage jets are flying with the unit insignia, which is an American Indian head painted on the tail right now.
And they've been referred to as the founding fathers of American combat aviation.
That is correct. Several of the pilots fought in the war from the day it began to the day it ended. They actually survived all of it. They were not flying when it started. Several were in the French Foreign Legion. James Norman Hall, who flew in the unit, was sent to France to write an article about the unit for Atlantic Magazine. So there were various ways for people to get there. The United States was neutral, so you couldn't – a United States citizen really couldn't fight in the war, but they figured out how to get there. And then the unit was formed in 1916, and they immediately went into combat. And then the unit fought the rest of the war on every front.
Was there anything that, like, just jumped out at you as a surprise during your research on this?
The sense of volunteerism, American military volunteerism, really jumps out in this story. And they were honoring Lafayette, who was the original military volunteer who came to volunteered with George Washington to fight in the American Revolution. So there's a real sense of paying it back, honor, liberty, fraternity. It's all there.
You mentioned travel to locations here and in France, a challenge in itself. But what were some of the other big challenges for you in this production?
The challenges have been finding the descendants of some of these guys. We actually found several sons and daughters of the original pilots who are quite old now. They're in their 90s, but they have vivid recollections of the ones that knew their grandfather and the ones that only knew them from the legend. The family has, there's photographs and there's diaries, and these guys wrote a lot of letters, which is a wonderful resource. One challenge is reading their handwriting. Not real easy to read some of the handwriting from 100 years ago.
This film, The Lafayette Escadrille, will be shown on Saturday, November 9th. And let's tell people how they can get involved. It'll take place at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
It's at the Air Force Museum Theater on their giant digital screen.
Which is, yeah, amazing.
It's a 100-foot screen.
Yeah.
And seeing your own work on a screen that big can be intimidating, but it's pretty cool. The film is shown at 7 o'clock on November 9th. Call the Air Force Museum Theater to find out how you might be able to attend.
Sure, and you've got a VIP early reception.
We have a VIP reception, and then the next day we're having a two-hour symposium with the descendants of these pilots. The French three-star general we interviewed in the film is coming from France to be a part of this symposium. And there's the historians from the museum and some of the authors who have written about these guys who we interviewed also are all going to be in one place.
The descendants have to be pretty excited about this.
They're pretty excited because this is the first documentary made about the Lafayette Escadrille. There have been other movies made about the unit, which the families really did not like. Flyboys being one of them. It was a lot of Hollywood license taken with the story. And we have made sure the families are pleased with our effort.
Dan Patterson is an aviation commentator for WYSO. Dan, before we leave, I just want to ask you, you've got a project underway that really has nothing to do with aviation.
There are no airplanes in this project, which is also coming to a conclusion. University Cincinnati Press has agreed to publish a book about surveying early America in the 1700s. And the thread through the book is George Washington, who was a surveyor when he was 16, surveyed Ohio when he was a young man, didn't really survey after that, but he surveyed his whole life, and he understood the value of measuring the land. And it's just a fascinating project.
Oh, great. We'd love to have you back in to talk about that project once it's going to be released around
Washington. It'll be published on Washington's birthday, February 22nd, next year.
Great. Dan Patterson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Building a more informed community with independent news and storytelling. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Coming up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.